I don't know much about acting. I've never studied it, but I've certainly enjoyed the experience of great actors. So when Jeff gave me the copy of his book here, I didn't know that I was going to get a master class on the craft, art, psychology, and history of the profession. And it made me think about a story about this octogenarian activist, singer, actor, whose name is Harry Belafonte, who told me this story about this guy I'm doing a film about, Lester Young. Just after the war, while going to the dramatic workshop at the New School of Social Research, Harry and his classmates, as Harry would say, would go to the Royal Roost, which is a jazz club in New York, and anoint a joyous closing of the day. So they would go to the Roost and they would listen to Lester Young. And at the table were his classmates, which, of course, were Marlon Brando and Shelley Winters and Rod Steiger and B. Arthur and Walter Matthau. And the students befriended Lester, who was interested in what they studied. And Harry explained to me that Lester wanted to know all about all the different aspects of theater. And Harry said, well, there's directing and playwriting and stage design and production management. And Lester asked Harry what he was studying. And Harry said, he was studying acting. And Lester said, acting? You study acting? How do you do that? And I like that story because I never really thought about how actors do that either. So Jeff gave me the copy of Existential Actor, and I soon found myself getting drawn in from Aristotle to Stanislavski to Tina Fey to Louis C.K. In just a couple hundred pages, Jeff explores this long history, codification, and philosophy of acting. So as a documentary filmmaker, I always loved that construct of all the world is a stage. But I was never a theater person. I don't know, something about theater that it wasn't one with me. So acting was not something I gave much thought to, but my experience was off the stage. And that's one of the great strands about this book. It's the existential actor, life and death on stage and off. So as Todd London says in his foreword, this book is for the actor who thinks about the relationship between performance and living, who thinks about doing and what that doing means. And the guy who lived in this place for many years would put that in another way. He would just say that life is the poem. But that interconnectedness between life and art gives this book some great added dimension. So Jeff Zinn.
I'll start standing and then I'll end sitting or lying down. I will end lying down. Hopefully not here tonight. Anyway, thank you for that wonderful introduction. I thought I was going to hear yet again another recitation of my bio, which every time I hear someone read it out loud as an intro to me doing something, I go, oh my God, I wrote that. That's terrible. Oh, please don't do that. Anyway, that was great. Thank you. What is technique, right? So I know there's one actor in the room and maybe more than one. Any other actors in the room? Good. Okay, good. We have actors. But all of us, I suspect, are artists in one genre or another, writers, painters. And the question is, how do we do this? How do we do what we do? And what is technique? What is the difference between inspiration, right, just doing it somehow, from the gut, without knowing anything, without studying anything, and really having a technique and knowing how to do something. And so this has been my kind of query, really, my whole life from when I was when I started as a young actor. And I started doing this, and at first it was just kind of from the gut and not really knowing or understanding anything about it. And then struggling and realizing that I needed to know how to do it. And so, and there's a line and there's a quote in at the beginning of one of my chapters from Tina Fey, right? The great comedian and writer and actress. And the quote goes something like, you know, I had studied Stanislavski and Meisner and, you know, the moment before and personal and private moment. And so she had sort of this grab bag of techniques that she had learned through study. But she said, I never really understood when I was on stage what I was supposed to be doing. What was I supposed to be actually thinking about? And what could I grab hold of? And that really is the essential question, right? I started thinking about this and studying this, and we really do need to have a technique because it's actually very difficult once you get beyond kind of typecasting where someone hires you just to be who you are. And a lot of, in my business, in the industry of the theater, a lot of casting is done that way. It's like you need a young person who looks in a certain way and you cast that person. You find that person and you plunk them in. It's one of the things that's so kind of horrible about being an actor. It's like the artist who's creating a mosaic. And picture an artist creating a tile mosaic, and they've got a big vat of loose tiles of different colors and shapes, and they go, okay, and they pick one out and they place it nicely, right? And the actor is the tile. The actor is loose in that bucket of tiles waiting, pick me, you know? And they get picked and they get, and when I figured out that I was the tile, I think that's when I decided I wanted to be a director. Because it's tough. It's tough being the tile. And I'm envious of actors who somehow seem to get plucked out time after time after time because there's something going on there. So I studied with a lot of different people, and then I had an epiphany, you know, 20 years in, and I started thinking about writing this book, and I started researching it. And as I sort of, and so a big piece of my book is, as Henry said, exploring the history of approaches to the art and craft of acting. And what I found was that all these different teachers have these lists of things that you might focus on and think about. And like a great example is a guy named Michael Shurtleff, who wrote a book called Audition. And he was famous for his 12 guideposts, right? So as you're entering, and this is for the audition, right? That you've got to carry 12 things in your head, you know? And I studied with someone who had studied with, this is how it goes in the acting world, right? You study with someone who studied with the person who invented the technique. So I printed it out before I came here. The 12 guideposts, well, each guidepost has like A through D, right? So that's like, do the multiplication on that. So it's like 1, relationships, 2, conflict, 3, the moment before, 4, humor, 5, opposite, 6, discoveries, 7, communication, 8, importance. I'm not even going to continue. So it's a lot. So there's 12 guideposts of Michael Shurtleff. Aristotle had the 6, and this wasn't about acting, but he codified theater and dramaturgy into plot, spectacle, character, music, theme. I'm forgetting, but he had six, right? Stanislavski comes along at the beginning of the 20th century. He's the famous one. And he was really a producer and an impresario and a wonderful actor, apparently. But he really wondered, like, how do the greats do it? And he decided that he was going to make a science of it and figure it out and come to an analysis of how great actors did what they did. And when Stella Adler, the great American actress, went to Russia to learn at the knee of the great master, she came up with this chart of the Stanislavski technique, and it and there's like 50 things here, 50 or thereabouts. And it's like a big pipe organ with, at the very bottom, at number one, and they're numbered, is work on oneself. And then it goes action, truth of feeling, creation of life, creation on stage, blah, 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 process of feeling, process of expressing your emotions. And then we get to all these little... Anyway, so there's a lot of stuff there, right? And then when the Russians went to New York, because they were starving in Russia, probably, and they said, there's people will pay us in New York to study with us, because we studied with Stanislavski, right? So they went to New York, and out of that, a guy named Boleslavsky came to New York, and Lee Strasberg, who founded the Actors Studio, and Sanford Meisner, who ended up forming Crosstown. There was another school. So there's my, and what they did was they took this huge thing and they reduced it down, right? And Strasberg, and to my mind, they reduced it too much. They ended up with single focus. So Strasberg's whole thing was emotion. And if you go to the Actor's Studio, it's all about the emotion. It's all about the tears. And Meisner's thing, and that's on here. That's on here. Stanislavski's famous thing is emotional memory, right? How do we get to the emotion? Well, you think you use your memory to go back and pull it out of your life experience. And Meisner picked up on something called the exchange of sentiments, speaking to the eyes, and what I call transaction, which is about talking and listening and going back and forth. And he invented something called the repetition exercise. I'm going to read something, and I'm going to get to this section. So I just want to sort of put it in your head, where I talk about in engineering. There's a thing that engineers and designers do, where you design something so that it's as light as it can possibly be, as simple as it can possibly be, while still having enough structure and strength to sustain itself, okay? And so as I was sort of absorbing all of these different techniques and approaches and 12 guideposts and 50 pipes on the organ and looking at the simple, at the minimalists who only chose one thing and kind of, that's it, if you just focus on that. My challenge was, when we walk on stage, what is the smallest amount of things that we can hold in our head, but that's, in other words, it's light, but it's not too light. that there's enough there. And I ended up coming around to four elements, what I call four elements. And these are none of these four elements are things that I invented. They're all things that have sort of, they all flow through all these different techniques. And one of them is, I call action. And action is what you do when you, what you set out to do when you're on stage. And the cliche in the method is, what's my motivation, right? We've all heard that. What's my motivation? But it's really not what your motivation is. It's like, okay, I'm motivated by I'm hungry, right? But now what do I do since I'm hungry? And you go out on the stage and it's like, I need to get the food. And so in order to get it, and that person has it, I'm going to, and there's a million things you can do to get what you want, right? That's the, and those are the actions that you take. I can seduce, I can use humor, I can bully, I can, there's a lot of different actions one could take to fulfill that need, that motivation. For centuries, really, most of the theater was defined by what I call shape, and that's this my second element, the physicality, the accent, and in Commedia dell'arte, we have all these archetypes of the El Capitan and the lovers and El Dottore, the pompous doctor, and all these different shapes, right? So that's very important. Action, shape, the Meisner bit, the repetition exercise of talking and listening. And as I'm talking to you right now, if I'm doing it well, I'm also listening to your reaction to what I'm saying. I'm not just sort of speaking to myself. Transaction, very important. And last but not least, the fourth element is surrender. And that's the single focus, in my view, of the Actor's Studio and Lee Strasberg, and very important to Stanislavski, the truthful expression of emotion. All right? Action, shape, transaction, and surrender. So those are my four elements. And I'm going to read from the chapter on surrender, which ultimately I think is maybe the most important, although none of them can exist by themselves. But before I do that, I just want to say that shape that all of us have, I want to talk about that just for a second, because all of us, everyone sitting in this room, has their own shape. And shape is determined by culture. Shape is determined, I mean, we, as children, we inherit shapes from our parents and from the culture at large. And, you know, it's different now. The son of the bricklayer doesn't necessarily grow up to be a bricklayer, right? We have infinite possibilities now, which is also confusing. But what these shapes do is that they buffer us from our awareness of our mortality. And that's where the existential part comes in, okay? That if all of us were to live in absolute, in the moment, in the presence of understanding that we will all die, and that death could come at any time, we would be paralyzed. But culture gives us armor. It gives us a bulwark against that. And we say, okay, well, I am the managing director of Gloucester Stage Company, God damn it. And I am immortal for a few minutes. You know, if you've ever gone around a room and you've ever sat in a circle in some workshop somewhere and everybody goes around and says who they are and what they do, okay, shape. All right, and a bulwark against insignificance and mortality. All right, so that was the epiphany for me that got me started writing this book, because if we enter a scene with an action of, okay, I'm hungry and I have to get some food, and that's my action in the scene and that's my objective in the scene, and my shape is, depending on the play, I could be a member of a gang in L.A., or I could be in the court of, you know, I could be Romeo in you know, Romeo and Juliet, or I could be, you know, I could be Willie Loman, right? But whatever the shape is, the prime action of every actor is to construct and defend that shape in order to sustain a sense of at least symbolic immortality. So I'm going to read from my chapter on surrender. And I begin this chapter with a little epigraph from Federico Garcia Lorca, which I love. And I stumbled upon this. He has a whole essay on duende. And when I discovered this, I said, ah, that's surrender. All that has dark sounds has duende. Those dark sounds are the mystery, the roots that cling to the mire that we all know, that we all ignore, but from which comes the very substance of art. This mysterious force that everyone feels and no philosopher has explained is in some the spirit of the earth, the same duende that scorched Nietzsche's heart as he searched for its outer form without finding it, and without seeing that the duende he pursued had leapt from the Greek mysteries to the dancers of Cadiz and the headless Dionysiac scream. We know that the earliest plays of Sophocles, Aeschylus, and Euripides were presented in competitive festivals honoring the cult of Dionysus, the god of wine and intoxication. Half mortal, Dionysus was the last god to be accepted at Olympus. He was an outsider, and so he becomes known as the god of the other. He represents wild nature, unchecked sexuality, and is often associated with androgyny. Quote, as a god of ecstatic possession, Dionysus left his worshippers without individual conscious identity. His female followers were called maenads, raving women, and are shown in frenzied trance-like states. Sound familiar? Is it too much to name Dionysus the original drama queen? He is the god of letting go, of letting it all hang out. He's the god of duende, of surrender. In many ways, surrender is the most elusive of the four elements. The ability to let go, to experience and communicate authentic emotion on stage is perhaps the most difficult skill for any performer to develop, no matter what medium an artist works in or what instrument the artist happens to play. An artist might be technically proficient and yet somehow unable to bring real emotion to the performance. Shape, action, and transaction are all attainable through work. An actor with intelligence and a willingness to focus can analyze a scene, determine which action is appropriate in the given circumstances, and then play the scene utilizing those choices. Shape is something we can achieve through diligent research. We can observe and mimic specific physical characteristics, study and perfect dialects. Transaction can be honed through different exercises. And the actor who relentlessly focuses outward and learns to listen will become a better actor. Surrender requires something different altogether. It's extremely difficult to produce an authentic laugh or even to smile on command, let alone cry without indicating. That is, fashioning the appearance of the emotion without really feeling it from the inside. The ability to surrender on cue is the holy grail of acting technique. The capacity to feel and to express authentic emotion is, of course, intrinsic to being human. We begin life without armor. From the moment we leave the womb, life comes at us, delivering pain and pleasure that we receive and surrender to in pure expressions of joy, fear, horror, and wonder. We laugh and cry, shout out, sing, giggle, and scream without filter, without self-censorship. Why do we stop reacting in this way? In a word, culture. As Oscar Hammerstein wrote, you've got to be carefully taught. Gradually over time, we armor up. Infants are allowed to mewl and cry and gurgle, but the patience of adults eventually wears thin, and soon we are asking our kids to be quiet. Each culture defines these things in its own way, and permission to surrender is granted differently from one culture to the next. In the West, at least, spontaneous eruptions of any kind tend to be discouraged. Boys learn it is unmanly to cry. Girls learn what is and is not appropriate to express. Gary, a hyper-paranoid character in a play by Laura Marks called Bethany, rants. They're socializing her. They're teaching her not to hit other kids and to keep her skirt down and raise her hand when she has to go to the bathroom. Every single thing in her body wants to do is getting smashed down by the military-industrial complex. And the worst part is it happens all day, every day, to everyone, and everyone just lets it happen. Every culture creates these mores according to its own set of rules. Why do cultures impose these buffers? Well, it's a collective response to the cosmic unknowns, the questions that plague all humans. Where do we come from? What are we supposed to do while we're here? Where do we go after we die? And each culture develops its correct answers to these questions, and those answers must be inculcated in its members. In society and in the individual, mortality awareness causes angst. And angst doesn't translate simply as anxiety. It's angst is both the terror of death and the exhilaration that comes with a full appreciation of life. Either of these two conditions, terror or exhilaration, is too much for us to live with in every moment of our lives. Terror is paralyzing. Exhilaration makes us do crazy things. We need to dial it back. If our children are acting out, bawling with fear or raving with manic ecstasy, they won't be able to learn much, will they? We place buffers between ourselves and those feelings. We deny the fact of death through elaborate mythologies whose function is to soften and temper these horrible, amazing realities. The shape we assume as part of a tribe, a family, a community, comes with a massive set of instructions about how we are to behave. We walk like this, talk like this, marry, dance, fight like this. We work at jobs or study or make art. We accomplish, or maybe we just hang out. But whatever we do it according to the rule book. We might decide to reject the rule book, to choose a different rule book that is a subset of the rule book. None of us wants to be thought of as conforming, so we have our idiosyncrasies. Our hair is short, but our sideburns are long. Every person is the product of cultural conditioning. And likewise, every fictional character exists in the context of a culture, contemporary, historical, or imaginary, and is the product of that cultural conditioning. The artist who creates, interprets, or portrays that character is, of course, also the product of his or her own cultural conditioning. we need to unpack how surrender functions for each of these separate entities. The living human being who's not a character in a fictional work, the fictional character that has been created, and the actor whose task is to portray that fictional character. So the human being, the actual human, not a character, is living out a heroic narrative shaped by his or her culture, feeling or suppressing feelings according to the circumstances. When events pile up and reach a breaking point, emotions burst through, no matter what buffers may be in place. Before it reaches that point, we have culturally acceptable releases, escape hatches that provide us with relatively safe opportunities to surrender. Some of these living on the edge activities can get us into real trouble. We get high with drink or drugs. We drive fast. We go snowboarding in avalanche zones, have unsafe sex with the wrong people. The flip side of denying death is seeking out more life. Entire industries are founded on this need. Amusement parks with death-defying rides, whole genres of movies, horror, thriller, slasher exist to bring us to the edge of oblivion and return us safely to our buffered lives. Children love to play on swings and seesaws and merry-go-rounds, and if they don't have access to any of that equipment, they'll simply spin around and around and around. In short, the armor we carry is both essential and unbearable. Now, the fictional character behaves according to the understanding of its creator and is shaped by the cultural context and construct of the fiction within which it exists. But the fictional narrative is shaped and controlled in a way that life rarely is. As actors, we must examine the character through the dramaturgical lens, attempting to divine the intentions of the playwright. Where does the character sit on the continuum from most open and vulnerable, most able to surrender, to most shut down and most heavily armored? Is the character already exposed? Is he written as a truth teller whose function is to tell it like it is? Or does the playwright introduce truth serums that trigger moments of surrender, allowing the character to escape from his normal inhibitors? In how many plays does alcohol fulfill that role? Think of the escalating pandemonium in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf as round after round of cocktails are consumed. What is the inciting event that triggers a shattering of the shape that has buffered the character from awareness of his or her mortality? The protagonist is swimming along in a heroic narrative that is working just fine, and then, blam, the established narrative comes apart. The causa sui project fails. The moment when this occurs is often the occasion for the expression of extreme emotion in some form. And it may take unexpected forms. People don't always react to catastrophic events in predictable ways, but they do react. Unless, of course, they're so heavily armored, so shut down, that they're simply too numb to react at all. Some characters may be locked in cultural cement, and it may be their function in the play to remain so. Willie Loman's neighbor, Charlie, aims low, succeeds low, and is perfectly at home in his identity. We won't see Charlie express emotions that are in any way extreme. Of course, Miller didn't write a play about Charlie. But he needs Charlie in the play to provide a reference point against which we can measure the other characters, Willie, Biff, Happy, who are pushing against their shapes, wrestling with their heroic narratives. The most interesting characters are often tested in such a way that they are forced to surrender at crucial moments in the play. Blanche DuBois arrives at Elysian Field swaddled in layers of armor the audience can immediately recognize as barely adequate to protect this most vulnerable human being. She erects barricades of clothing, makeup, chatter, and dim light, all in an effort to keep at bay the forces, including her own memories, that constantly threaten to rush in and crush her into non-existence. One of Stanley's functions in the play is to batter away at Blanche's facade until it comes apart. Stanley himself is a masterpiece of armored male dominance, certainty, mastery, and preening sexuality. But even his armor is shattered when he comes face to face with the prospect of losing Stella, the most important transactional figure in his life. Nora in A Doll's House presents a facade of perfect wife and mother. Her bubble of deceit gets bigger and bigger as she must expand the lies that hold everything in place. Her husband, Torvald, is also carrying around an edifice of pompous, self-created identity, the bank manager for whom Nora is the ideal accessory. The tarantella she dances provides the perfect and necessary release of sexual and psychic tension. When Nora's deceptions are revealed, an explosion is triggered that demolishes Torvald's armor and reveals him to be the small-minded, shallow man he truly is. This revelation initiates Nora's catastrophic loss of self. Seeing Torvald revealed, she can no longer sustain the character fictions she has so strenuously maintained throughout the play and throughout her life. With this loss, however, she's free to discover who she might truly become. A new, more authentic heroic narrative will be forged. So those are the fictional characters. The performers, the artists, the practitioners who will be required to interpret and inhabit these characters are at the same time living persons with their own built-in psychological makeup, living out their own heroic narratives. These human beings have been raised in specific cultural contexts. Each of them carries culturally constructed psychological armor that protects against death awareness. Each arrives with his or her own shape. The degree to which the actor can bend and transcend that shape will determine how much he or she gets to transcend the typecasting decisions that may be made by directors and casting directors. The actor is the result, perhaps the victim, of the layering up of psychological armor that his or her family, his or her culture, decided was appropriate. Some artists are lucky enough to have escaped an overly constrictive upbringing. Risking a diagnosis of oppositional defiant disorder, they might have instinctively rejected the conditioning that was forced on them. They somehow managed to grow into adulthood without being crushed by the cultural judgment of parents, teachers, and peers who tried to force them to layer up the emotional and psychological armor. Some lucky few find it easy to express their feelings, to surrender. Their authentic emotions are available to them. Most of us are not so lucky. Learning to surrender may require a lengthy process of unlearning, unpacking the layers of negativity and shame that prevent us from feeling and expressing those feelings. Well, maybe lucky isn't the right word. Some of our most brilliant artists have had the quality of being so open, so vulnerable, that they ultimately were destroyed or self-destructed because of that vulnerability. Marilyn Monroe, James Dean, Montgomery Clift, Janis Joplin, Amy Winehouse, and Philip Seymour Hoffman come to mind. With tougher skins, they might have survived, but they also might not have been nearly as worth watching. The paradox of mental health is that to function in the world, we need the layers of armor that protect us from psychic assault, but those layers deaden us and prevent us from feeling. Finding the right balance is akin to a classic engineering problem. Engineers always strive to design an object, a bridge, the wing of an airplane, with just enough strength so that it can withstand extreme forces, but light enough so that it has an aesthetic quality of ease. Too much structure and the thing becomes bulky and coarse, too little and it collapses. It's the actor's obligation to perform a feat of psychological self-engineering, to strip away every layer but that which will allow the actor, the artist, the person, to function in the life space he inhabits away from the stage or the lens. These three entities, the real non-literary human, the literary invention, the artist, actor, interpreter, may exist on different reality planes, but they're all driven by the same life-death paradigm. All three exist for a reason. They inhabit a heroic narrative, a causa sui project. As you move through the world, you're in a constant state of constructing and defending that narrative. No matter what else you're doing, no matter what other goals you may have, and no matter what other items are on your agenda, this is your primary action. It isn't static. You may wake up one day and decide you want to do something else, be someone else. So you make those changes and move on, and then that becomes your heroic narrative, your shape, and you carry on constructing and defending that. So the process of how we do this seems mysterious and esoteric, the process of stripping away the armor in order to become available. And that may explain why we so willingly submit to the sway of gurus who promise to deliver us unto brilliance. Richard Schechner said of Grotowski, "The tradition he comes from is that of the seer shaman." Acting technique as worldview creates fierce advocacy in its adherents. An advanced copy of this manuscript triggered an angry outburst from some contemporary followers of Delzart, who felt I had not shown sufficient respect for his teachings. It may have that effect on the followers of other one true paths. There are many existing strategies and techniques for shedding the armor and cultivating the ability to express authentic emotion. Tadashi Suzuki asks us to stamp on the ground. Perhaps in the stamping, we are cracking open the armor. Jean-René Toussaint leads workshops in freeing what he calls the primitive voice. Grotowski is no longer with us to demand our total act, but others are surely making those leaps into the unknown. Whether we explore traditional psychotherapy, mindfulness meditation, or emotional memory exercises, we would do well to contemplate how the armor we carry buffers us from our fear of life and death. And I'll finish with a story told by Patsy Rodenberg, who is a wonderful teacher. Beautifully illustrates the power of surrender as it connects the experience of an ordinary human being with a brilliant performer. She describes speaking to a group of mostly actors and artists while on a book tour when she notices a little man in a suit, and he didn't seem to be part of the audience. And I started to get very upset because he was very upset. And at the end, as she's signing books, she notices him again. I saw him hovering over there, and I thought, oh no, I've got to meet this man. And he waited until most of the people had gone. And then he came up to me and he said, "I don't like theater." And I said, "Okay." And he said,
"I don't like beer."
Theater. Theater. And I said, "Okay." And he said, "My wife and I once went to the theater. We didn't like it." Seems that the man had seen a performance of the Trojan Women. Rodenberg asks him why they didn't like it, and he says, "Oh, there was this actress. She made a sound. She lost her son." "Oh, yes. Andromache," offered Rodenberg. "She loses her child, her young son." He said, Yeah, we didn't like her." "But why didn't you like her?" asks Rodenberg. "She made a sound. It was really embarrassing." And then something seems to come over the man. He got really quiet, and there was a change in his energy, and he looked down to the floor. And he looked up at me, and he said, "A year ago, a policeman came to my door and told me my daughter had been raped and murdered, and I made that sound." Rodenberg pauses. in her retelling of the story and says, "Whoever that actress was, I bless her." And we should all bless her. In a moment of unfathomable rage and grief, a horrible sound erupted from the guts of a man in a moment of pure surrender. It was the dark sound of Lorca's Duende, from which comes the very substance of art. The actress who is able to unleash a sound like that from a place deep within herself deserves our thanks and our appreciation. The man may not have liked her, but he probably needed her. Thank you. Thank you. And as you define ecstasy, right?
I'm talking about and the reward for the actor.
Sure. I mean, I think any true release of emotion is, in a sense, ecstatic. I mean, how many of us have had the experience of really releasing emotion? I mean, you could be bawling your eyes out. There's something wonderful about that, because you're free, you're letting it go, you're not bottling it up anymore, and you can call that ecstatic, but I don't know if it's ecstasy in the sense of the word that most people would use it, but I get your point.
But that's why it's difficult. Most people don't get it and wouldn't even try it.
Yeah. Yeah, we keep it at bay. It's too difficult. What else, William?
What is the percentage of actors who are totally natural and don't need any schooling at all?
There
has to be a percentage.
37.6. Since you ask for a number, I've researched this very, very thoroughly. I don't know. I mean, I do believe that there are some people who come to it who, as I wrote, are more open, are more available, and they don't need the process of unlayering that I describe, but I don't know what the proportion. I think it's rare, frankly. I don't see it that much.
There are artists who are just totally natural and never taken a lesson in beautiful things, as there are writers.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I'm curious to know how much.
I have no idea.
I think it's a lot easier for musicians than it is for actors.
Right.
Who are speaking this nonverbal language. Mm-hmm.
True. Yeah, and I talk about that a little bit in the book, because I just part of my own personal experience, I started as a musician. I was a singer-songwriter, and that sense of letting go, that sense of surrender in the act of singing, I found that to be very easy. And it was what made me good. It was what made me effective as a performer. And when I got into the theater, which was when I was, you know, first year in college, I naively thought that I was going to just bring that over into the theater, right? And what I found was that it was much more difficult to do that as an actor, because when you're as an actor, you have so many, all these different moving parts. You have lines and you have blocking and you have other people to interact with and you have the text, and there's all these kind of mechanics to deal with that kind of get in the way of just this pure flow. So and that's why there are a gazillion acting schools and theater programs and coaches and, you know, and books on acting and all of that. It's, you know, I mean, people go, people study, certainly study music to learn the technical part of it, but they don't learn. They don't go to learn how to open up.
They have to be someone else. Actors have to become someone else, which is sort of not something you do naturally.
Right. Putting on a, but see, for me, that's the easy part. In other words, assuming a different shape is a technical thing, right? You can study accents and dialects and put on costumes and learn about a culture that's very different from your own and become another person. But being real inside that person, and this was my epiphany, that all of us essentially are, whatever the shape is, we're all in the act of building and defending that shape to the outside world. We all do that as individuals, and every character is doing that. And if you can get in touch with that, then you can bring that to the role.
Do you remember George Frazer?
Hang on. Let me grab another.
No, I was just thinking. You know, I read about Marlon Brando and said about acting.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean, and he had said, and I'm sure everybody's heard it, that everybody's been acting all their life.
Mm-hmm.
And and I thought about, like, you know, about when we come into the world, mm-hmm. you know, we are cultured. It's not like we kind of. We choose that culture. It's something that's imposed upon us. And so, like, in order for us to understand that, it's a very complex thing for a child to enter. Who am I? What am I doing here? And,
mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And part of the survival is acting. And it kind of made sense to me, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so complex and very confusing because you're relating to people you've never seen in your life before
mm-hmm.
as you're entering into the world. So part of the way that we survive is acting and listening and responding.
Mm-hmm.
You don't understand what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And because I know that, like I said, I've told you I was a little hard of hearing and that would put me in another kind of realm. Like, you know what I mean? But then, you know, and then we begin to find out that a lot of this armor, there's a kind of an armor that we build up because, you know, because the cobalt comes out of nowhere and all of a sudden it's like light can't be trusted anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we start building up these armors, you know, over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And then, you know, so over time we begin to see that these armors are actually kind of have a form of suffocation.
Sure.
Because eventually we feel like, you know, unfree. And then there's a kind of a line
mm-hmm.
that wants to get beyond the culture of armor, this armor. You know
right.
I mean?
And there are things we do to relieve ourselves of the armor.
Many different forms. It has many different ways of taking shape. You know, maybe people through alcohol or
sure.
workshops.
Exactly.
Or going to see the guru. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And so even now, like, I mean, what does the word authentic self actually mean? So I'd like to ask you that question in that context of what
mm-hmm.
I just described. What
right.
is authentic self, you know
right.
what I mean? And I don't, you know,
well, you know, that's a great question. And I think a lot of people come to a point in their lives where they realize, wow, this shape that I've adopted, I didn't really choose it for myself.
Yeah.
It was kind of handed to me and I kind of bought into it. But who, what would I be if I wasn't that? And,
mm.
and you know, a lot of us make a fairly conscious effort to rediscover ourselves and find out who our authentic selves are. And, you know, that's a real process and it's tough.
Yeah.
Did I see a hand?
Yes, I wanted to ask a technical question.
Okay.
Your enunciation of words is beautiful. It's clear.
Thank you.
It's loud. Did it take much learning, special studying? How is that accomplished for an actor who has to project
right
to the audience?
You know, I think Well, sure. I mean, I've been doing it for a really long time. I think I'm blessed with, or cursed with, you know, a little, some equipment that, so it comes easier to me than others. You know, I don't quite know, but thank you. I'll take it as a compliment. I don't think I started somewhere like really different and then sort of shed. I mean, people will study to like drop terrible accents, or, and I know a lot of actors who need a lot of vocal work and whose voices are not strong enough and who don't enunciate. And it wasn't that hard for me, but I have other issues.
Now we're getting somewhere.
This is sort of a follow-up, Jeff, because I've read your book, as you know, some time ago now, and that particular portion that you read again tonight, it seemed to be impact more on me than it did when I read it. Is that because of your enunciation and your acting?
Well,
do you think that could be, I mean, that's just my observation. I really...
Thank you.
More emphasized tonight than when I read them myself.
Right. Well, I should read to you all the time, Harry. Just, I'm available, okay, for a price.
The ear can be very powerful.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I agree with that. Well,
Thank you. Well, there is an audiobook version of my book.
Is it so, Madman.
It's true.
Is it you reading it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course. Couldn't.
But you wouldn't be.
Absolutely.
There.
I'm sorry?
You wouldn't be the actor up there. There's an element to that, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's... I mean, as I said in this, the transaction thing, it's like, you know, when you're... The actor needs to connect, you know, and know that... The audience is, I mean, whether it's a scene partner or whether it's the audience, there's a transaction that has to happen there. And to be effective, you need to know that you're reaching the intended audience. So that's something that I have worked at.
So I'm trying to clarify.
Sure.
The surrender aspect of a performer in a role. So we come with all our stuff.
Right.
We have our shape. Somehow in that process, you meet a fictional shape or mm-hmm. character with their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You have to strip away things that you carry as your own armor and definitions. Enter into the shape and armor of the character is what you're saying is essentially that process is... The surrender.
Well, no, I think, I mean, one of the things that I come to in this is that there are things that you focus on in the moment of being on stage, right? And then there are things that are sort of. Remember, I held up the Stanislavski chart, and I said that at the very bottom of it, number one is work on oneself. So there's work that you have to do before you even walk into the first rehearsal to be ready. Mm-hmm. And I think that work of being emotionally available and open is part of that work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen... on stage. You have to kind of be there. You have to allow yourself. You have to have already shed the armor and then kept just enough of it so that you can keep it together to get through your day. Right? I mean, and it's tough. That's hard, you know. And there, as I said, there are people who and it's probably not that they stripped it away and now they're stuck, but it was never there. You know, Judy Garland, right? I mean, just this, just raw, you know, stripped bare, and so vulnerable. And but that's what makes these people amazing, you know. Action and transaction are two things that you can come onto the stage with and focus on. So they answering the Tina Fey question, like, what am I supposed to think about when I'm on stage, right? To me, those are the two, like, in-the-moment things. The shape piece of it is sort of research and study and practice. And, you know, we know that classically trained actor, like, if you go to, you know, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, you'll take classes for hours in court dancing, right? And you'll do, you'll learn how to do the dance, because as they did in that era, and the way you comport yourself, the posture and the grace and the ease with which you do that, that's part of the culture of that world. And you have to get good at that. Right. And so once you're there, then it's like, oh, I know how a lord moves now because I did the dancing. It's all in the dance. Humans are uniquely aware of mortality. I mean, an animal has an has a survival instinct, right? They're driven, like, they know that, like, instinctively that there's danger and there, you know, it's flight or fight. But we have this awareness, which is deeper and more pervasive, of ultimate mortality, that, oh, I will die. And it's not just, and it's not just that I will eventually die, but I could actually die at any moment, right? And if you, and you realize, and that awareness, it can be paralyzing. And so there are all of these mechanisms that protect us from that. That's the thing, and that's not natural, that's human.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, there's, you know, nature, humans are part of nature, but they're also separate from nature. I mean, and, you know, that's what theology, you know, theologies are, edifices of theology are built on that.
Surrender, you would minimize that self-consciousness.
What would?
In the effort at surrender, the experience of surrender, you would minimize the self-consciousness, which could be seen as another way of becoming more natural in that role, right? So, it's a scary thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But achieving it is very fulfilling, temporarily.
Indeed.
Right. I like what you were saying about, like, the way you said it, like, you know, I mean, about the fact that that if we really took it in, that we could die at any moment.
Right.
We wouldn't be able to function.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the beautiful part about, which I never thought of that way,
mm-hmm.
of having armor.
I'm sorry.
Being in denial.
I'm sorry.
That it is, it serves its purpose in the right way.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's, because I always saw the opposite, because I always thought the other side. Now I'm starting to see it now that culture and denial can be very, very useful.
Mm-hmm.
And it serves the purpose for us to live, to create a world of illusion and move forward.
Right.
And start creating.
Well, I mean, there are different mechanisms to buffer us from that. And for, you know, many religions provide literal immortality, life after death, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is the mythology that allows people to feel protected from awareness of death, right?
Yeah.
If you don't have that, there are other symbolic immortalities, and that can come in the form of, and often does, in the form of accomplishment. It comes in the form of creating family. I mean, there are many different mechanisms that allow us to feel that our lives have purpose and meaning and are valued, and that we're, you know, that it's okay that we will eventually die, because, you know, while we were here, we were able to accomplish something. Now, the other night I was watching a thing on the solar system and the universe, and, you know, how, like, the sun, you know, the whole thing is just going to get snuffed out in a billion years. And I'm like, oh, my God, what's the point? Yeah. Let's just stop now.
Myself and Susan are talking about this article that she sent me. It's in the New Yorker. It's about Ray Kurzweil. Yeah. Ray Kurzweil is the inventor.
Sure.
And Susan sent me, and it's called The God Pill.
Uh-huh.
And the whole thing about the God Pill, including the guys that run Google and everything like that, trying to find a way to immortality.
Yeah, good luck with that. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, Rory.
You were going there.
The God Pill, which is an article in the April 3rd issue of New Yorker, is about the immortalist.
Uh-huh.
So Ray Kurzweil, everybody in Silicon Valley apparently thinks that immortality is not out of the question.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Good.
So, like, we should go.
Now, there's a causes sui project for you, right? We will defeat death. Yes. There's an algorithm. The immortality algorithm. If we could only just figure that one out. Cool. Yeah. Tower. Yes. Okay. Now we're going there. Okay. Anything else?
Aren't there some cultures that do treat death as part of life?
Sure.
And then, so what's their way of being?
Well, sure. I mean, death is the ceremony and the ritual of death is important in all cultures. And it's a way of absorbing it. It's a way of dealing with it. Now, some, I mean, there are different degrees of that, but
most of us seem to want to get it over with, make it go away as fast as we can.
Yeah.
Whereas others seem to.
Right. Well, I recently attended a memorial service for a Catholic mass of the mother of a good friend of mine, I've been, you know, to many church services, but it's certainly not part of my experience. But as I was sitting there, I was so appreciative of the ritual and how comforting it was. And although I could sit there and say, well, you know, I don't believe in any of this, but so what? You know, I mean, it absolutely has its purpose, and it does make us feel better and more alive.
So one's causes sui includes something about how you're going to deal with that, I guess.
Yeah. The culture provides us with a construct that helps us explain and feel better about our awareness of our mortality, right? It takes many, many, many different shapes. Thank you. Thank you very much.